9 months into the fiscal year, Pennsylvania will finally have a budget. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The state's budget impasse will be over by the end of this week. WHYY's Mary Wilson reports that Governor Tom Wolf will allow a supplemental spending plan to take effect.
The state will have a full budget in place soon, but it won't sport the governor's signature.
I cannot in good conscience sign this bill. I cannot in good conscience attach my name to a budget that simply doesn't add up.
Wolf says the $6 billion supplemental funding plan is unbalanced and bad for the state, but he says approving it means much-needed money will go out to schools, agricultural programs, and others. The governor was facing pressure from fellow Democrats in the legislature, some of whom weren't sure they could back him up on another budget veto nearly 9 months into an impasse. Wolf will also allow funding plans for the state-related universities to take effect without his signature. He is vetoing a companion bill to the budget known as the Fiscal Code. Top Republican lawmakers say they're still figuring out the consequences of that move. Top Democrats say it's not necessary to end the impasse. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
Of all the recipients of state funding, schools have been hardest hit by the delay. Joining me with perspective is WHYY education reporter Kevin McCurry. So, Kevin, what does Wolf's action today mean for public schools?
Let's take a step back here for a second and provide some context. Wolf campaigned for governor on the idea that he'd secure a major statewide funding boost for public education. He hoped to restore the money districts lost when federal stimulus dollars expired under former Governor Tom Corbett, and then some. So to do this, he would need to convince the Republican-held legislature to agree to some sort of tax increase. In the weeks before the election in 2014, I questioned him about the difficulty of negotiating in divided government. What's going to change when you come in?
The new governor.
Just you being there. The cult of personality.
I think I'm sensing that there are enough people in the legislature in both parties who recognize that we've got to make some changes. And the Marcellus Shale tax is an easy one.
So, Dave, that clearly hasn't been the case. And now, almost 9 months after his first budget was due, Wolf has agreed to a much more modest Republican-preferred plan that includes no tax increases.
I am going to allow HB 1801 to become law. This means that schools will stay open through the end of the year. But unless Harrisburg changes its ways, they won't have adequate funds for next year.
All right, Kevin, let's do the numbers.
All said and done, how much new funding will schools get? Well, in total, between today's announcement and the half-year plan that Wolf agreed to in December, K-12 public schools are seeing a $230 million boost. But Wolf quibbles with this figure, and here's where things get complicated. The state was set to take out this huge bond to help some districts pay for building upgrades. But Wolf thinks it's a bad idea to borrow more money while the state still has a structural deficit, which he says his plan would have fixed, the one that, you know, they're not going with. So he's vetoing that bond, and thus some districts may have to pay for the upgrades by cutting classroom spending. So worst case scenario, Wolf says that this budget that he's allowing to go into effect will actually cut classroom spending by $45 million.
Kevin, in that context, do we have any sense about how much of the funding will come to the school district of Philadelphia?
No, not yet. As we just heard in Mary's piece, while Wolf is allowing the budget to go into effect, he's vetoing the fiscal code bill that acts as the roadmap for how money gets divided up. So to Republicans, if you're vetoing that code bill, that means that none of the new money can be released. It's like frozen in limbo. But Wolf is intent on spreading the cash around as he sees it. He says he can do that. He did it in December with block grant money, and he mostly favored districts where there were cuts that, you know, especially hurt districts years ago, namely Philadelphia. So if Republicans disagree with that tack, they could challenge Wolf in the courts if he decides to act unilaterally. So there's still not so much consensus there.
But if we put the political jostling aside, what are you sensing from education advocates?
Well, in general, people are happy because it seems like schools will get enough money to stay open the rest of the year. But, you know, there's disappointment that Wolf didn't deliver a bigger win. I did talk to Donna Cooper, Executive Director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, And her thoughts, were a little more nuanced. She referenced her time working with former Governor Ed Rendell when she was in Harrisburg with him, a time she described as much less bitterly partisan.
I doubt even Ed Rendell could have done better than Tom Wolf under the conditions that he has there. And moderate Republicans and Democrats are being held hostage by far-right ideologues. And why are our schools in this situation? It is not because Tom Wolf failed. It is because people are not holding those legislators accountable for what they've done.
And Kevin, no rest for the weary. Next year's budget battle picks up right where this one left off.
That's right. There's another deadline here, June 30th. And again, there's going to be this push to strike a grand bargain, one where the deficit is fixed, schools see a big boost, and changes of some sort come to the state pension system and liquor system.
Kevin, thanks for taking us to school.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY education reporter Kevin McCrory. Despite facing federal corruption charges, Philadelphia Congressman Shaka Fatah could win next month's Democratic primary. What happens then if a jury finds him guilty after he's secured the nomination? WHYY's Aaron Mozell found out.
Fatah is charged with racketeering, bribery, wire fraud, and other offenses for allegedly misusing hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions, public funds, and charitable donations. Federal prosecutors say he orchestrated it to help repay an illegal loan he took for his 2007 campaign for Philadelphia mayor. Fatah's trial is scheduled to start May 2nd and expected to last a couple months, which means a jury could have a verdict months before the general election in November. Election law attorney Kevin Greenberg says convicted politicians typically resign shortly after the fact.
The 535 members of Congress, despite what people like to say about them, are by and large very honorable people who take the ethics and responsibility of their office very seriously. And the peer pressure within that body, the peer pressure from his fellow members of Congress, his friends who he's worked with for 20 years, to not embarrass them, to not bring stain upon the House of Representatives, would be quite great.
Even once sentenced, removing a member of Congress is not automatic. If Fatah chose to resign, party leaders from the 2nd Congressional District would caucus and choose a replacement for the general election. The district includes parts of Philadelphia and Montgomery County. Fellow election lawyer Adam Bonin says the selection process is private, the ultimate smoke-filled room. He also says it's high stakes.
You're choosing a member of Congress in the safest of safe Democratic districts and someone who could hold that seat and hold power for decades.
Fatah could withdraw from the general election all the way up until ballots are printed and distributed. That and other election mechanics are typically set in stone 20 to 45 days before voters head to the polls. In this case, around mid-September. But Greenberg says, hypothetically, a convicted Fatah could decide not to withdraw and remain on the November ballot, and even win another term. The House, however, could then vote to remove him from Congress, leaving the district without a representative.
We all hope that if he is not convicted, we don't have this problem. And if he is convicted, that he steps down, we don't have this problem. It does no one any good to have a convicted person serving in Congress.
But it's not unheard of. In 1798, Vermont Congressman Matthew Lyon was reelected from jail after being convicted under the Alien and Sedition Acts. He handily beat his opponent and went on to serve two more terms in Congress after moving to Kentucky. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
WHYY will host a debate with the challengers for Fatah's congressional seat. That debate takes place Monday, April 11th. A plan to close some roads in New Jersey's largest forest to reduce damage by illegal off-roading has been scrapped. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the State Department of Environmental Protection will focus instead on enforcement.
The DEP is increasing police patrols and adding signs to Wharton State Forest, making it clear where people can and cannot drive. The new plan comes months after the DEP was criticized for an effort to close roads in the forest to solve the off-roading problem. Officials wanted to restrict access to sensitive areas, but opponents said that would hurt law-abiding citizens. Larry Haina is a spokesman for the DEP.
It's been a tough task. I mean, it's a forest that has people who love it for different reasons and for different activities. So we think we're striking the right balance.
While most people agree that more law enforcement of off-roading rules is necessary, many of the roads are sand and dirt, and some worry that without a map defining what is and isn't a road, enforcement will be difficult. Carlton Montgomery runs the Pinelands Preservation Alliance.
So many paths have been cleared illegally or by the Forest Fire Service for a particular need and never restored that there's going to be a lot of controversy, a lot of argument over what is really a road anymore.
Also part of the plan, the DEP will repair and improve roads damaged by off-road vehicles. Kayaker Bill Caruso says the plan is a fair compromise.
I don't think there's any reasonable party out there that can look at this and not say, there's something for everybody here.
When does the Wharton plan go into effect? The DEP says it's already rolling it out. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Imagine you're among 30 people in a room, and then imagine learning that half of you look around and you'll get HIV. That's right, 15 out of 30. That's essentially what federal officials recently projected among black men who have sex with men in the United States. It seems devastating, but as WHYY's Alana Gordon reports, many are looking to a newer prevention tool that could dramatically change that outcome.
My reaction was that I was quite shocked.
This is Deontos Keys. He's 26 and an organizer of Black Gay Pride in Philly. Keys says without context, the stats that half of gay black men and a quarter of Latino gay men could become HIV positive in their life can feel like a blow.
We have been packaged to be victims of this epidemic, but there hasn't been enough investment to celebrate our resilience within that, to celebrate our successes.
Keys says basic HIV education and awareness are out there, but the strategies to curb the epidemic need to change. Dr. Kathleen Brady, who coordinates City AIDS activities, agrees. She sees those projections as a worst-case scenario.
We need to do something different, and we have something different.
Brady is talking about pre-exposure prophylaxis therapy, also known as PrEP. It's a pill that, if taken regularly, prevents a person from getting HIV. Brady says PrEP, in combination with better treatment for those who have HIV, could dramatically alter the course of the epidemic. Problem is?
It's being underutilized.
PrEP was approved in 2012, but still, it's pretty new. That's why the city recently hired a PrEP coordinator to educate doctors. City health centers and other clinics are now offering it. And Philadelphia has been awarded millions in federal dollars to step up outreach efforts. Keys, again with Philly Black Pride, says that's great in theory, but it will only work if those efforts come from within the community.
Those type of conversations happen in the most informal ways. They happen in homes, they happen online in chat groups.
I'm holding a clear white bottle.
22-year-old Rami Garnett decided last year to take PrEP. He shows me the pills. They're blue. He swallows one.
Done.
Once a day?
Once a day.
Garnett says he heard about PrEP from a friend in Atlanta. He Googled it and found a clinic in Philly.
Nobody's worrying about my health besides me. So I put my life in my own hands and decided to get on it.
He doesn't want those HIV projections to reflect the reality for him and others. And he says now it doesn't have to. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Still ahead, we'll try to figure out what it takes to secure delegates in Pennsylvania's Republican primary.
This is a very complicated process. It is beyond confusing. So there is no way to know for sure what's likely to happen.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Rutgers Camden supports WHYY and will host an open house for undergraduate programs 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday, April 1st. Rutgers Camden offers 34 majors, internships, and experiential learning programs, international studies, and opportunities to work closely with Rutgers faculty researchers. Details about Discover Rutgers Camden Day on April 1st are at camden.rutgers.edu or 856-225-6104.
Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, supports WHYY and Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Colorectal cancer is one of the most preventable types of cancer. In many cases, it can be prevented or caught at an early stage. Fox Chase Cancer Center gastroenterologists are specialists in screening for colon polyps and cancer. Whether you need screening or treatment for colorectal cancer, where you go for care can make a difference. Learn more at foxchase.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Pennsylvania's presidential primary comes so late in the election cycle, it typically doesn't matter. But this year's Republican primary season has been anything but normal, and the three remaining candidates are scrambling for every delegate they can get. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that the candidates are finding the rules that govern GOP delegate selection in Pennsylvania are peculiar and challenging.
Candidates are used to winning delegates when they win primaries. In some places, a win gets you all the delegates. But in Pennsylvania, a candidate could crush his opponents by 30 points in the April 26th primary and come away with precious few delegates.
This is a very complicated process. It is beyond confusing.
Terry Madonna is a political scientist at Franklin and Marshall College.
So there is no way to know for sure what's likely to happen.
Winning the Pennsylvania primary gets you just 17 of the state's 71 delegates on a winner-take-all basis. The rest are technically uncommitted, elected directly by voters, three from each congressional district.
So when voters go into the voting booth, they're going to see the word uncommitted under every candidate for delegate.
Loman Henry chairs the Ted Cruz campaign in Pennsylvania.
So the ballot will not give you any direction as to which presidential candidate those delegate candidates are supporting.
So to win delegates in Pennsylvania, presidential campaigns have to identify their supporters and recruit some to run as candidates for delegate. To get them on the ballot, they had to have done this by mid-February.
I'm Jamie Klein. I'm 68 years old, and I'm an insurance executive.
The Trump campaign got Klein to run for delegate in central Pennsylvania. He's an enthusiastic follower of Trump. In fact, here's what he says to those who claim Trump's a threat to the Republican Party.
If we're killing the Republican Party, it's because they need killing.
Klein is devoted to Trump, but he's unknown to voters in Pennsylvania's sprawling 5th congressional district, which includes parts of 16 counties. A presidential campaign's task is to somehow tell voters which candidates for delegate are theirs. If a campaign's lucky, it gets some mayors or state legislators on its slate. If not,
they'll run grassroots campaigns. They may do mailers. They'll probably consider digital advertising, hopefully radio advertising, maybe even some television.
That's Chris Bravikos, who chaired the Marco Rubio campaign in Pennsylvania. The Trump, Cruz, and Rubio campaigns all placed candidates for delegates on the ballot. John Kasich's campaign appeared to be less active. That's unfortunate for him, since Rubio's departure gives him a better chance to do well in Pennsylvania. There's another way presidential candidates can pick up delegates. That's to try and cajole or convince delegates elected with the help of county Republican organizations who will be truly undecided. Calvin Tucker of Philadelphia is one. He was a delegate 4 years ago, and he's gotten some attention from presidential hopefuls.
In June of last year, I had an opportunity to meet with Carly Farino.
Tucker has met with six candidates and says he most wants to nominate an electable one. Delegates like him will bring some leverage to the Republican convention. But given Pennsylvania's idiosyncratic rules, it's unclear how many of its delegates in Cleveland will be allied with presidential candidates and how many will be truly uncommitted. I'm Dave Davies, WHYY News.
This Easter week marks 6 months since Pope Francis's visit to Philadelphia. Our commentator this evening says the important, momentous occasion should be put in perspective with the other events celebrated this week. James Martin, a Philadelphia area native and Wharton School alumnus, is a Jesuit priest and editor-at-large at America, the National Catholic Review.
The best thing to my mind about the visit of Pope Francis to the U.S. was simple. We got to meet him, and he got to meet us. Remember, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the first Jesuit pope, had never even been to the United States before his papal visit last September. There were even rumors that he wasn't all that fond of Americans. Perhaps not a surprising attitude from a Latin American toward a former colonial power. But it was clear from the moment he stepped off the plane in Washington that he enjoyed us and we enjoyed him. And that is no small accomplishment. As the leader of over 1 billion Catholics, the Pope is required to make decisions regarding the good of the entire Church. And while the U.S. Church is not the most important part of the Church, it's important that the Pope knows something about us. Funny enough, when he left the States, he summed up his reactions to the three cities he visited. On the plane ride back to Rome, he told journalists the following, quote, "In Washington, the welcome was warm but more formal. New York was a bit exuberant. Philadelphia, very demonstrative. So, three different kinds of welcome," end quote. And I thought, that's pretty good for someone who only spent a few days in each place. So the Pope took our measure. It was also an important reminder for American Catholics that the Pope is not some far-off, unapproachable, semi-mythical figure. He's our pastor. More basically, he's a human being. Some of my friends who waited for hours to see him at Independence Hall said to me with wonder, "I can't believe I just saw the Pope at 4th and Walnut." How will Easter change for me this year? How will Pope Francis's visit influence my celebration of the most important day of the Christian year? Well, I have to say, not much. Now, Pope Francis is a hugely influential figure for me. He encourages me to be more merciful and to care more for the poor and marginalized. He makes me want to live a more authentic life. Overall, he makes me want to be a better Jesuit, a better priest, a better Catholic, a better Christian, and a better person. But here's the thing. He's not Jesus. And he'd be the first to tell you that. And the meaning of Easter, that Christ is risen, that life triumphs over death, that hope triumphs over despair, and that love triumphs over hate, both predates and will outlast Pope Francis. Of course, it's that very message that made Jorge Mario Bergoglio want to be a Jesuit and a priest to begin with. So the Pope's visit to the U.S. 6 months ago electrified American Catholics. What should electrify them more is the timeless and even more electrifying message of Easter: Christ is risen.
Father James Martin is editor-at-large of the magazine America, the National Catholic Review, and the author of Seven Last Words, An Invitation to a Deeper Friendship with Jesus. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with production assistance today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.